We've had athletes throw a 2 ounce ball 118 miles an hour. So we know the arm can go that fast. Can we prepare the body to adapt and accommodate a 5 ounce baseball in competition at 118? And that's kind of what I'm beginning to believe is possible.
Ready for war, never back down, give me some more. We came for the title, killing the game, dead on arrival. No mercy for rivals, this is for glory.
Welcome into another episode of Patrick Jones Baseball. Hope everybody is doing well wherever you are listening to this podcast. We have listeners in every single state in the United States, and also we have people listening in countries that don't even speak English. It's crazy. I mean, we have people who are listening over in China, Japan. We have people who are in Africa, different countries, and the Czech Republic, and it's crazy how much this podcast has continued to grow over the years. So appreciate you all for listening and helping spread the word of the podcast. Today's episode, we have a very special guest. This is going to be a pitching and throwing type of episode. So if that interests you, you're going to want to stick around because we have someone who is a pioneer who revolutionized how pitchers are developed in Tom House. So Tom has been around a very long time. He's 75 years old now. He played in the major leagues. He coached in the major leagues, and he has been working with pitchers. He's been working with quarterbacks, anybody who throws. He's worked with Tom Brady, Drew Brees, to pitchers, Nolan Ryan, Randy Johnson. The list goes on and on. And so we're very lucky to have him on the podcast today. He gives an inside look into how he views pitching, what he's learned over the years. I get into some different questions that people had asked, reached out and asked me to ask via Twitter to Tom. And then we also talk about something that he has actually helped develop, and it's an app that uses artificial intelligence to help diagnose a flaw, pitcher's flaws. So you can literally just take your phone, go to the App Store, download his app. It's called Mustard App. We'll put the link in the show notes. And so you can just take a quick video of yourself throwing or your kid throwing or your player, whoever it is. They do, through artificial intelligence, they do an assessment on him, and then it immediately spits out different drills that he needs to be doing in order to move more efficiently. It's really cool. I've used it myself. So I think it's something that you should definitely check out. And again, appreciate Tom coming on the podcast. He was fantastic. I heard so many good things about him, and every one was true. He's just a first-class person. One of the cool things that I have been working on, I would say the past 8 to 10 weeks, is every single week I've been doing a weekly newsletter. It's called The Hitting Chronicle. And so each week, every Tuesday, I send out a newsletter. It's on hitting development. And so I go into different drills and routines and mental game techniques and just everything that I know and everything that I've been able to research on different ways to be able to help hitters. So if you're interested in signing up for that, it's completely free. You just head to patrickjonesbaseball.com, put your name and email in, and you'll be added to the list. So patrickjonesbaseball.com, put your name and email in, and you'll be added to the Hitting Chronicle list. Okay, here we go. Tom House. This is my time, I grind and shine. I put in the work and push the line. Okay, Tom, we're now live on the podcast. I appreciate you coming on today.
It's my pleasure. Anytime I can be have a captive audience for X amount of time, you got me.
So you are a legend in, I wouldn't say solely even in the baseball world, but just I would say the throwing world, right? Because you've worked with quarterbacks and pitchers and position players, and you did, and doing research on you. I mean, you've been all in on this for decades. I mean, you took out, did I read this right? You took out a second mortgage on your house in order to buy a piece of technology for pitching development. Is that true?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I'd like to give credit where credit's due. This guy, Coop Duren, who was at that time, I played against him in high school and we knew each other through college. And he went on and became a researcher and a coach at University of Hawaii. He called me one day and said, Tom, have you seen this new technology? It's called motion analysis. We can actually look at human movement at 1,000 frames a second. I said, I'm in. Where do we go and how do we do it? So I did. I got a second on the house and we bought an aerial system. Gideon Aerial was actually up at Cota de Casa. It was a tennis technology to start with. And that was the beginning of it. Now, 35, almost 37 years later, we've got 1,000 plus major league pitchers in the computer, 1,300 hitters. We got 300 or 400 quarterbacks. In other words, we have one of the best databases in the world when it
The
comes to
best.
hitting.
I can't, I mean, you have to have the best.
Well, I don't think there's anybody there. There might be people that are smarter, but there's nobody that has more volume of data than we do. And that's the basis for all of our models, which, again, I didn't know what I was getting into, but it was we learned on the go, and I think we were the first, and I still think we're running ahead of most people that are out there.
Yeah, I heard you say the hand is quicker than the eye, but 1,000 frames per second don't lie, which I loved, by the way. That was awesome.
You've done your homework. Good for you. Yeah,
Yeah.
what we taught, and I probably am one of the last standing from old school. I have, when I first got into professional baseball, the old schoolers were still running the show. They didn't have fastest pitch, last inning. They didn't have radar guns. They video was just getting started. In other words, it was very primitive. And what coaches taught is what they thought their eyes actually saw. And we know now that our eyes lie to us. So it wasn't so much that we were disproving, we were just basically giving credibility to what the great coaches were actually seeing and what everybody else was trying to teach from. So a model that was surviving but flawed has been getting better and better. And I actually believe that Patrick, today there's more technology out there and more smart young people that are taking advantage of it than ever before. So the sports world is better for the experience. The hard task is, with all this quantification and measurable, do you have something that, once you've identified a problem, do you have something you can teach with to fix the problem? And that's where I think the old school and where I am right now, we've been able to find ways to teach because we've bridged the old and the new.
When one of the things that I've heard you say before, which I mean, the way you put it, I think was fantastic, is, and this is speaking to what you were just talking about, is, and I believe the quote you said was, the biggest issue coaches have is they fix the things they know how.
Right.
And could you elaborate on that? 'Cause I, when you said that really caught my attention.
Well, we have a tendency as parents, coaches, and athletes to, once we've seen a problem and have come up with a way to fix that, it's like when you have a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. It's along those lines. And what happens with successful coaches, once they come up with a couple of teaches, a couple of tricks to make kids better, they don't allow themselves to see anything more. It's called the confirmation bias. And what motion analysis has done, wireless EMG to see what muscles actually do while we're looking at the motion analysis, the blood chemistry is involved with nutrition, and then the mental emotional that allows us to, if we've got movement figured out and we're functionally strong enough to do it, can we go do it under the pressures of competition? All that, there's so much out there that they're putting together and getting better with the total teach. And the hardest part for a coach, and how old are you, Patrick?
31.
Okay, so
Just turned 31.
you would still be in what we call our a window of trainability that has to do with muscle. First window is nerve, the second window is muscle, then there's skill acquisition and skill retention. And in each one of those windows, there's so many good people using technology to get better. And I think they're letting go of one way to look at something. And once you get over your ego, and talking from personal experience, when we first got involved with all this technology, I was a little kind of confrontational when I ran across someone that didn't buy in to what we had shown, what I thought was proof on the way things should be done. But it takes a while for people to let go of what they believe in and what they think they're good at, and accept something new. It's a little challenging, but I do believe we're as a sports world, we're moving in the right direction.
What's something that maybe when you were younger and you just started coaching, what's something that maybe you didn't expect to happen years later? Like, is there any evolution to a pitching mindset or throwing mechanics that you wouldn't have expected to occur when you first started coaching?
Well, from the mechanics standpoint, I don't know if you're old enough to remember who Tom Seaver was,
Oh, yeah.
but he had a model, and because he was so good and one of the first visible, worldwide superstar pitchers, his teach was drop and drive. And when we got into filming superstar pitchers, we saw that not everybody had a drop and drive delivery. In other words, you can't cookie cut what an athlete does. Without getting too deep, every athlete has a signature, just like a fingerprint, on how he throws. And there's one set of rules, but each athlete interprets it differently. And in the time involved with a total delivery, it might look different to your and my naked eye, but when you get it in the computer and you use the model to quantify it from, they all do the same basic stuff. So my initial teach was rotate, collect, drop, and drive. And now we know for the most part that you find a posture and you keep a posture. And then there's two quantifiable variables that are independent and nine that are dependent. And based on those variables and how they apply to you, you come up with a delivery that is efficient and teachable. Then you train the muscles to support that delivery with however many throws you need. You use nutrition and sleep to recover. You prepare, compete, and recover. And then the mental, emotional, we can actually look at a pitcher's brain now, or a quarterback's brain in competition and practice, and see how his emotions and his stresses affects the way he performs by looking at the brain waves. I'm drawing a blank on what they call the 30,000, whatever the brain waves are measured by. And I'm getting old, so I'll remember this at midnight tonight. But anyway, putting it all together, there's no way that I would have thought I would still be involved in the instruction at 75 years old. And it's not because I'm any smarter or whatever it might be, but the fact that technology has allowed us to keep learning and looking at things differently. And I think that's what separates the avid learner. Can I take a little sidebar real quick? I feel like I'm rambling a little
No,
bit, but
please, the floor is yours.
okay. It's called long-term learning. And basically, we learn to learn, we learn, and we learn to relearn. And underneath each one of those categories, there's a number of different ways that you can improve the way you process information. So when you take long-term adaptive learning and you break it into where an individual is mentally, combine it with where he is physically, then the net result is that the information and instruction that you're putting in front of your athletes and that the coaches are using to teach, it all gets more efficient. And that's where we are right now. Not everybody agrees on all the variables. But everybody is, what I'm seeing is they're agreeing to disagree. It's a collaboration rather than a confrontation. Does that make sense?
100%. I think collaboration is the way to go. To your point, nobody knows everything, and there's different contexts with different players and backgrounds and things like that. So I think collaboration is the way to go, to what you just said.
And what you just said is perfect, because baseball is international right now, and we have to give kudos to the World Baseball Classic. The way you teach if you're in Japan is different than the way you're going to teach if you're in Latin America. And the way you're going to teach in Latin America is different than the way you're going to teach here in the United States. So it's the combination of all. The net result is the athletes are getting better. And the fact that when I first got to the big leagues, nobody threw 100 miles an hour. Nobody did.
You saw that in a documentary, and you hear that. I was watching the Nolan Ryan documentary research. I saw you in there, of course, and I was going to ask you about that. So you do believe that the hardest throwers, they weren't throwing as hard back then as they do today, like everyone says?
Maybe a few of them did. I think if you saw that whole documentary, with today's technology, Nolan probably would have been sitting 103 and showing 105. So, but they at that point in time, remember that we didn't even have radar guns when I first got to the big leagues. So, but I know for a fact the research that we were doing up at USC in like 2009, 2008 through 2011, we started working with weighted balls and protocols to fix GERD. And GERD is glenohumeral internal rotation deficit. So we were using heavy and light balls to fix GERD, and everybody's velocity started getting better. So from 2011, when we presented our first research at the Injuries in Baseball Clinic with Dr. Andrews, from that day to where we are right now, there's 300 or 400 mile an hour throwers on every staff. And that's in 14 years is how long it took to get that. So we're living in a really exciting time. And I know for a fact, now this will make you smile, we've had athletes throw a 2 ounce ball 118 miles an hour. So we know the arm can go that fast. Can we prepare the body to adapt and accommodate a 5 ounce baseball in competition at 118? And that's kind of what I'm beginning to believe is possible. And then what scares me, I'm a pitcher and I really don't like hitters, but the hitters are adjusting. The hitters have adjusted to 100 mile an hour fastball. There isn't a guy playing in the big leagues that can't catch up to 100 mile an hour fastball if he guesses right. And that was something that 25 years ago, nobody would have ever believed. So it's exciting times, Patrick. It's really cool.
What's something that, like a drill that maybe you did back in the day that maybe today you aren't as sold on, or you don't do with players because you don't think it benefits? Like, are there certain drills that maybe you've strayed away from over the years?
When I think back, we've pretty much, I have to quantify this or qualify it. One of the things we've done, either me personally or whether it was San Diego School of Baseball or the National Pitching Association or working up at the University of Southern California or being a pitching coach for the Texas Rangers, I never used a drill unless we had basically quantified it to where we knew that it was, that it would actually work, that it has statistical validity. So one of the drills that has stood the test of time, and you and I talked about this off camera, is the towel drill. And the towel drill has morphed from what initially was just to make the arm go faster, something I learned over in Japan because they all went through the throwing motion with a 12-inch towel, to where we can actually facilitate teaching mechanics. We can make the arm go faster. We can make the arm get stronger. And if we put a target up that you need to slap with a towel, it becomes a skill drill. So something that 30 years ago, when I first brought the towel drill back from Japan, it was just I go through the motion and make your arm go faster. And now it can make your arm go faster. You can make it weigh 6 or more ounces by putting a ball inside the sock towel, and you can build strength. And then if you try to hit a target, it's stride plus five, and follow the protocol, it becomes a skill drill. So again, it starts off as a single, a single drill, and becomes three drills that are all productive depending on where the athlete is, with his age, where he is in the season. Trying to think if there's anything that I have given up on. I really, maybe I've gotten smarter about long toss. I'm a firm believer in long toss. And when I first got to the major leagues, I would basically every third day try to throw the ball as far as I possibly could for 15 to 20 throws. And it's morphed into something right now where you can actually predict with your long toss around where your recovery is. And instead of lofting it, throwing it on a line, it's a way to improve your spin rate. In other words, the more research we got on stuff and the more things we did to make it actually efficient, not just guess at it, the more applications we found that truly work to help an athlete get better.
Yeah, I'm a big believer like you are in long toss. I know for me, even as a player, it helped me strengthen my arm, and also just from the recovery aspect, I was able to maintain that strength throughout the season. Going back to the towel drill, do you see that players or coaches do the towel drill wrong? Because, and again, my background isn't pitching, but I've done a lot of research in preparing for this interview. And so I see online what, that the towel drill can cause early chest rotation. It can cause like pushy arm action. Like, are there certain things that people are doing wrong that make sometimes the towel drill inefficient for pitchers?
Yeah, you're very observant. The towel drill protocol, if you follow it, doesn't cause any of the things that you're saying. And if you do it wrong, then I can, I'll accept that criticism. But if you follow from start to finish the protocol the way it's designed, here's a perfect example. Nolan Ryan, didn't throw off the mound in between starts the last 6, 7 years he was with us with the Texas Rangers. He did all his work on flat ground, and he used the towel drill because you can do tons of repetitions and on the mound with repetitions and take nothing out of your arm. So I think one of the reasons he pitched till he was 47 years old is we actually stumbled into things that will allow him to maintain or what I would call is skill retention. With the aging process didn't affect him quite as much because we were able to work on the nervous system without him getting into muscle failure, and his recovery was affected accordingly. And so the only time he ever really threw a 5 ounce baseball with intensity was in pre-game warm-ups and games themselves. And the when you have a superstar that can do a drill and it actually has efficacy that you can quantify, it carries over. So your observations and what you're seeing about people criticizing the towel drill, that criticism is justified only if they're not doing the towel drill properly. If they follow protocol, we can't find anything wrong with it.
Gotcha. Speaking of Nolan Ryan, the all-time greats, you've been able to work with the best of the best. I mean, Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Nolan Ryan, like, I mean, just the best of the goats. We all know statistically how great those players are. What's something the public doesn't know about them?
Well, you and I both know that the superstars, the Hall of Famers, they're different. They're put together different. Their capacities for taking information and instruction and then turning it into something that in competition is productive, they're special. But they have the same fears, the same, they get just as nervous as you and I do. They've just got a better way not to let it affect them. And what I've seen across the board, because I've also been involved in golf, and we have Hall of Famers in golf, in football, and in baseball. And the one common denominator is this burning desire to get better every day at something in their life. And it's not 15 or 20%. It's like 1% better every day. And while the aging process will slow them down in one area, they'll make up for it by getting better in another area. And that's what sustains a career over the long haul. But I'm just as proud as of the, like, people don't realize that Jamie Moyer pitched just as long as Nolan Ryan did, in fact, a year longer than Nolan Ryan did. And on a good day, Jamie's best fastball was 85, 86 miles an hour. So not only what I'm proud of, not only did it work for the superstars, but it also worked for the everyday athlete. And I'm just as proud as the kids that probably shouldn't have played in high school that end up pitching on varsity, or a kid that wouldn't normally have gone to college, but he was able, because of grades and the things he'd learned from our people, was able to get into and participate and compete in the collegiate level. So it's all relative. I think I've been blessed to be able to be in front of these superstars. And I think that because we delivered science-based research, information, and instruction, it really helped their careers too.
Yeah, I think for everyone listening, I mean, this story that I'm going to say next is perfectly describes Tom House and how you are what you say, what you're about helping players from the very beginning. There, Randy Johnson, when you were coaching with the Rangers, he had a lot of command issues, and you actually saw some issues that he could clean up pretty, I won't say easily, but you saw some things that he can improve upon. And even though he was on another team, he wasn't even on your team, the Rangers, he's on the Mariners, I believe, at the time, you still went out of your way to help him. And he gave you credit for that. And he was like, man, I can't believe nobody else on, our own team, when I was in high school, like, nobody else saw these issues. And here's this guy who is competing against me, and he's coming over and he's helping me. And I think that it's perfect testament to you, Tom, where it's like, you're just about helping as many players as possible. You don't care about the outcome necessarily in terms of wins and losses and all that stuff. You just care about the development and touching as many people as possible.
Well, you've been really kind with that story. I need to give you the, you made me look really good there, but it was actually, we were in Seattle and Nolan was involved with the same thing. We had just finished, Nolan and I had just finished Nolan's workout. And we were sitting in the first base dugout, kind of looking down toward right field where the Mariner bullpen was. And Randy was going through his routine for his next start. And there were balls going all over the place. And again, Nolan and I were just sitting there. And Randy, when he was walking back to the clubhouse from his bullpen, I'd known Randy from USC. He was a Trojan way back when. So I'd known him enough to say hi. And so when he walked by, I said, how you doing? He said, I'm not doing so good. I'm having trouble throwing strikes. And Nolan popped up and said, I'll tell you what, Randy, Tom and I are going to be here tomorrow about this same time. Why don't you come early with us and we'll chit chat a little bit. We'll talk about it. So while it's nice that I get credit for a lot of stuff, it was a combined effort. I doubt maybe Randy wouldn't even have come the next day if it would have been just me offering. But the fact that Nolan said, come on, maybe we can figure something out. And as luck would have it, we made one small adjustment with his stride and he went off. That was his ignition toward being a Hall of Famer. His command got better. And you had it right. About 3 weeks later in Texas, he struck out 18 of us. And he makes fun of me. He says, it probably cost me my job because I got fired that winter. The bottom line is, yes, I'm a teacher, and there are times when I probably share too much. But the bottom line is, if you got something, you can help somebody. Why not help?
That's incredible. What's your take on some of these new rules in MLB in terms of it affecting pitchers? I mean, do you think that because they have to work a little bit, like, here's one of the questions that I got. If you improve a pitcher's tempo, can it change things for the better holistically, but for the worse mechanically? So meaning, like, maybe they get more batters out, but at the same time, it could be worse for them from a mechanical standpoint.
Well, this is one where I feel like baseball actually got it right. Our research shows that when you're trying to repeat a complex movement, the time involved between repetitions is best between 13 and 20 seconds. In other words, if you go faster than 13 seconds in between pitches or slower than 20 seconds, you're not quite as efficient as you could be. Now, I would like to say that I helped Major League Baseball come up with that, but they came up all on their own, maybe just by guessing, by golly, that 20 seconds is that magic number. So from a pure research standpoint, that's good. Now, I'm not quite so sure about being able to throw over to first base and those constraints there. But the idea of speeding the game up and making sure a pitcher doesn't take, 40 seconds in between pitches, I think in the long term, this is going to be a really good a rule. And I think the pitchers will adapt accordingly. And so will the hitters. Yogi Berra had a great phrase, don't think you're hurting the team. And if you can speed your repetitions up, you don't have as much time to think about something. All your thinking should be done in your preparation, not in your competition. And so I think the timing, that's a good thing for both pitchers and hitters. I don't mind the size of the base. That's not going to be a significant difference. But I don't like the arbitrary, you can only throw over twice or whatever those things are, that because that does affect the control of the running game. But we'll see how. It looks like the minor league experience last year, if I can remember the numbers, the games were like 24 minutes faster overall. If you can take 20 minutes to half an hour off of a big league game, then to the average fan, the tempo looks a lot better. And I think the younger fan will agree that there's not so much downtime.
Yeah, I think you brought up that was a great point about this, that how if you don't have as much time in between, you don't have as much time to necessarily think. It's kind of like making a diving play, standing up, throwing it over to first base versus a routine ground ball, and you field it and you have time to get it, think internally and not just letting it rip. So that's a great point about how you think that's going to help based on the research that you've done with pitchers over the years. I want to transition a little bit because then I want to talk about your app and I want to build a bridge right into talking about your app. And I have a couple questions from the youth side. So I had a couple of people reach out. The first question that I got was kids who are going at a young age and they're transitioning from a little league size field to the 60-90 field. And so how do you help manage a young pitcher's transition during this time period?
Well, we had mentioned earlier, and I'll flesh it out a little bit, there are windows of trainability. The first window, and this is all age-based, the first window is a neurological window, and that's for all intent and purposes, 7, 8 years old till 13 or 14 years old when testosterone shows up. In that neurological window, that's when it's little league distance and pony league distance. And when you get to the larger fields, That's when the second window kicks in, which is muscle. And then you can move to a larger field. And remember that bodies are different. I don't know if you can remember back. There were teams I played on where that 6 foot 2 inch 12-year-old that's been shaving since he was three is a different human being than I was, that I had to jump around the shower to get wet as a youngster. So with the qualifications with age specific, we know this, and I'll share it with you. If you grow 1 inch or gain 5 pounds, it pushes your neurological and your muscular back 2 months. So a kid that grows 6 inches and gains 20 pounds, 6 inches puts him back 12 months, and 20 pounds puts him back 8 months. So this 14-year-old is really still 12 years old. So they're age specific, but it's point in time capacity in combination with their chronological and their biological age. So that would be one caveat. And with the greater distance, whether the fields are bigger or smaller, obviously it doesn't work for the outlier as that 12-year-old. Like if you go back to Bryce Harper, Bryce Harper was a big league talent when he was 14 years old. But the outliers like that don't come across or come along very often. There should be some kind of provision when you've got that type of athlete, he can play up. And there also should be a provision, again, this is my wish list. If you've got that 6 foot 3 inch kid that is like a baby giraffe out there, and where he was skilled when he was like the middle of last summer when he was only, 5 foot 1, and now he's 6 feet tall and he can't walk and chew gum. That athlete should be able to play down with a group of kids that are experiencing the same issues neurologically and with their muscle. So there's one set of rules, but there's some interpretations for the outliers. Did that make sense?
Yeah, so it's not necessarily about just the age of the kid, like just because they develop differently. It's more so the skill level and, whether they're growing or, putting on weight versus how tall they're getting. Like there's a lot of different factors that go into it. So you can't just categorize kids by just putting them into a bucket just based upon their age.
You said it perfectly, and that's part of this mustard thing that we're working with. We want parents to identify that your kid was one of the best players last year on the team, but he's had growth spurts and weight gains. And this year he's striking out, he can't throw strikes, he's tripping over everything. We have to make parents aware, coaches aware, and athletes aware that it's just a point in time. I'm going to take this a step further. Baseball has figured out on the elite level that a 6'5" pitcher is 3 years behind when it comes to mechanical efficiency than a 6'1" pitcher. So we did the research on it that the average height of a Hall of Fame pitcher was 6'1½", and he weighed between 195 and 200 pounds. If you look at staffs today, Patrick, the staffs that there are 6'6", 6'7" guys out there. So organizations know that taller pitchers, all things being equal, a taller pitcher has a better chance of success in the big leagues. But you have to be aware that it's going to take 2 to 3 years longer in their physical and their mechanical development to be able to be effective and healthy on the major league level. And Randy Johnson is a perfect example. He was 26 years old. I think either 26 or sneaking up on 27 when Nolan and I hit him up in Seattle. So be aware of that. The people that are listening to this podcast, be aware that it is age specific, but chronological age and biological age sometimes don't match up. Am I pushing too hard?
No, I definitely understand what you're talking about. It makes perfect sense. I thought that I had no idea about doing the Hall of Fame, how tall the pitchers were. 6'1.5", I believe you said, 195 pounds. So that gives a lot of hope to a lot of just people, a lot of kids out there are just going to be average, right? You don't have to be a 6'7" monster to pitch in the big leagues.
You're exactly right. And it's 6'1.5".
Okay.
All right.
Well,
But
6 foot. Okay.
that's 6'5". In other words, all you have to do is go back to the old fields and look at the size of the dugouts. 6'7", 6'8" guys are banging their heads in the old fields, are banging their heads in the dugout every time they stand up. So the game has changed with the height. Not only are athletes bigger, faster, and stronger, they're way taller than they were back when. And then you get an outlier like Drew Brees, who was just barely 6 foot, but he had other things that allowed him his ability to visualize where a receiver was supposed to be. He was one of the first guys that I heard to throw a receiver open. What he lacked in his ability to height-wise see over the line, he had this ability to visualize where the receiver should be. And in working with his receivers, he would share that vision, say, look, I'm going to throw the ball here. And even though I can't see you, I know you're going to be there. And if you are there, we're both going to go to the Super Bowl. If you're not, then we're going to be watching on TV. So it goes both ways.
Tom, one of the things that you'll hear, and I'm sure you've heard this before too, is coaches at a younger age prioritizing winning over development. And I think there's a lot of parents out there who are doing research on their own. They're listening to this podcast with Tom House. They're doing all, online, looking for ways to help their son or daughter. And so when they hear a coach tell their son on the mound to just slow down just so they can throw strikes in a meaningless game at a young age, I mean, how should they communicate that with the coach that, hey, this isn't good for them long term?
Well, I'm going to go to your original statement. We live in an outcome world, unfortunately. You get college scholarships because you have straight A's and or you're doing well in the field. What people don't realize is that you have no control over outcome. The only thing you have control of is process. And because kids are rewarded with outcome, they don't understand that you learn more from your failures than you do from your successes. People are afraid to fail right now. Parents, and I had trouble with my kids. It tore me up when my son would strike out with the bases loaded or give him a base hit and lose the ball game, whatever it might be. But if I could impart one thing and share it with you, the kids you're watching, the athletes you're watching on TV today are the ones that failed fast forward. They didn't let failure get in the way of their advancement. Anybody can go good. The bottom line is you learn more from your failures than you do from your successes. So if you'll take outcome out of the equation, and understand that process is the only thing you can control. If you're not getting outcomes that you desired, then there's something wrong with your process. You blame a kid for a bad outcome without telling him why or what he could do to improve it is missing the point. And unfortunately, parents with good intentions and love for their children don't like to see their kids fail. They have to kind of let it go. Now, it can't be with morals, mores, and ethics, and you can't have them kids jumping off of three-story buildings. That kind of failure is not what we're talking about. But my mom used to say, if it didn't kill you, it's a good experience. And if I could reinforce one thing with you and the people that are listening to us talk today, fail fast forward. Don't be afraid to play, what would happen if I tried this? And the key to fixing it is, okay, why didn't it work? If you're not afraid to fail, and you do, and ask yourself why, and then it becomes a learning experience. And again, I'll say this with 100% certainty. The athletes you're seeing on TV that are very successful have probably failed more than the athletes that are watching them on TV.
Wow, that's powerful stuff right there, man.
But it's so hard. Do you have children?
I don't know.
Well, when you do, it tears you up when you see one of your kids fail at something because you know they're hurting. And the bottom line is allow them to fail, but not the same way every time. And you keep that up front by saying, what went wrong? What would you do to fix? How are we going to help you not do that, get that outcome again? So again, fail fast forward, ask yourself why, and that will get you to the big leagues way faster than if all you think about is being successful with an outcome.
Beautiful. That was great advice right there. Tom, I don't know if you know how much you're on the internet and some of the new things that are coming out, but I've seen, Chat GPT and artificial intelligence, and there's all these different just new things that are coming out because of how fast technology is going. And a couple weeks ago, I'd say probably maybe a month ago, a coach that I was working with was explaining to me about how his son was struggling with pitching and, from a mechanical standpoint. And I don't really know a ton about pitching. I mean, I know enough to be dangerous from a mechanical standpoint, but what he told me he did is he ended up finding an app, the app called Mustard App. And so he was telling me about it online. And he said, it's awesome because you can just take a video, and through artificial intelligence, they do an analysis of the his son throwing, and then they give him drills to help improve his mechanics. And I thought, this is like too good to be true. And so I went on myself and to the app, and I was like, man, this is unbelievable. Like, this app is incredible. And so, first of all, congratulations on building like an incredible app. I mean, that thing is an absolute beast. If you're a pitcher out there, if you're a parent, if you're a coach, like, you have to check out this app. It's called Mustard. It's fantastic. I mean, it uses artificial intelligence. It uses Tom House's brain, which has accumulated thousands and thousands of data points on throwers for decades. But take me through on why specifically you decided to develop this app and kind of just the background of it.
Okay, well, you're setting this up for me real well. I'll hang out with you anytime.
Okay.
The bottom line is we know that artificial intelligence by itself is faster and more efficient than anything else that exists. But artificial intelligence combined with human intelligence, when you can humanize it, personalize it, there's nothing more powerful. So that was our initial goal. Can we give a parent, a coach, or an athlete everything that a superstar would pay 30 grand a weekend to come in and get a motion analysis, an EMG assessment for strength, and a nutrition and sleep analysis, and a mental emotional to see where his hertz of electrical activity, what they're doing during the competition? That's a $30,000 weekend. Can we put that on a cell phone? And put that cell phone in the hands of a mom, a dad, a coach, or an athlete, and give as much of the expensive information and instruction we possibly can to for free. Now you've humanized the artificial intelligence. You've involved what I would say the biggest asset in the world we have today is our young people. And we're giving them a chance to stay in a sport longer to develop all the good stuff, the empathy, being on a team, dealing with adversity, understanding the benefits of failing and not failing the same way twice. All the things we've been talking about, that was the goal of the Mustard app. And it's pretty close. It's not perfect. We're still debugging and working on stuff. And when I am looking at the report card that emotion that a Mustard app will give you with your movement analysis. There's still things that are being tweaked, But all in all, it's way ahead of what I thought it would be. And I think we've got something special, something that actually works.
You definitely have something special. I mean, I haven't seen anything else like that that's out there right now. And I think it's especially cool because it's one thing to do an analysis on a pitcher, on a hitter, and you get all these data points or graphs or whatnot. But then it's like, okay, what do I actually do with this? And but this actually spits out drills that you can do based upon those, data points or the analysis that has been given. Now, did you, so I assume that you took all of your information throughout all these years of collecting on throwers, and so you took that information and there's different like points of, hey, if a player is at this data point, they should be at this one instead, and so they need to do this drill.
Right, that's exactly what we did. And remember earlier in our conversation today, I said we took the best of old school and the best of new school and put it together in what we think is a really good app with Mustard. And that's exactly what we're doing. There's all kinds of science out there, technology out there that can measure and quantify. Excuse me. Measure and quantify, but very few people have a deliverable or a teachable to go with what you've measured and quantified. That's another reason I think the Mustard app is separate from anything else that's out there, because for everything that we identify as inefficient or a problem, we'll give you a drill, a skill drill, a neurological or a muscle drill to remediate the issue that the Mustard app determined. So again, we're getting better every day. We've got a product that I know works very well, and it's a product we're continuing to improve daily.
Yeah, everybody listening, I would highly recommend you check out the Mustard app. Like, and I mean that sincerely. Tom House, appreciate you for coming on the show today. You're the best man. I mean, you're a pioneer in this space, and we appreciate your time.
Well, I really appreciate it. For future, if I can ever do this or help you with anything, just let me know. Okay,
Thank
Patrick.
you.
Have a blessed day.
Thanks, you too.
Breaking them off.